Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Bren Jones. I'm here with Greg Limo-Stein, and I'm very pleased to present episode one of Cloud 259, running on air. So, tonight, it's February 3rd. Just watched the Super Bowl. Baltimore beat San Francisco 34-31. But the big news for running fans, of course, is that Skechers had an ad in the second quarter for running shoes. So, given that Skechers is buying time for a running shoe ad, we can rest assured that the running boom is still happily in place. So the running boom will be the topic for tonight. What we're going to do is on this show, each episode, we're going to have a different topic. Tonight's will be the running boom. We'll try to investigate the topic in some detail and hopefully learn something, teach something, get something out of it. We're going to try to take a look at the numbers when we can. There are a lot of numbers in running, and we want to see if we can basically tease out some lessons that aren't being covered on other sites, and also, of course, to entertain. So, Greg, why don't you tell us a little something about yourself?
But first, Bren, are we going to discuss this cryptic name we have, or are we going to keep the mystery going for a while?
All right. So Cloud 259 is in reference to attempts to break 3 hours in the marathon. So last summer, a group of us were training, running further and further from the office as far as we could, whilst getting away from it, and whilst getting away with it, I should say. And finally, we hit a boat that said Cloud 9. And Greg, I believe it was you who quipped Cloud 259. So in trying to break 3 hours for the marathon, I think that's where we'll end up.
And you would have broken it if it weren't for the debacle that happened to the New York Marathon this
year. We all know what happened to the New York Marathon, and we'll leave that for another episode.
But anyway, the show is not about us in particular. It's about the running in general. So we have a lot of items to discuss on this, our inaugural show. And in the meat of this episode, what we call the workout, Bren will be discussing the running boom. We'll also talk about the elite scene with Rupp in Boston, Legat in Germany, and Yuki in Japan. We'll take a quick trip to the library for some running books. We'll have a little training talk. And finally, we'll get on the soapbox, which is our little editorial or kind of like a little Andy Rooney section, maybe a little different. We'll see what happens. But, Bren, why don't you start it off with the running boom? You've been looking into some stats and trying to determine whether it is a second running boom or the third running boom or not a boom at all. What have you found out?
Cool, yeah. Well, that's basically the gist. You know, I'd read one blogger was talking about the third running boom. I'd read in several places about the second running boom. And I thought, okay, well, what are the actual numbers? And I think anyone who's made it this far to listen to this show is probably familiar with the idea of the running boom and the causes of it. I think what's often cited as the causes of the running boom in the 1970s is Frank Shorter's marathon win at the Olympics in 1972 at Munich, and also the Complete Book of Running by Jim Fix in 1977. Basically, a lot of people started running that hadn't been running before, and we started to see the numbers in marathon finishers really escalate rapidly. In 1976, there were 25,000 people finished marathons in the U.S., or there were 25,000 marathon finishers, I should say, which is the difference being one person may have finished several different marathons. They would be counted twice. But by 1980, there were 472% more people had finished the marathon. So basically, there was a huge escalation in the people who were running road races and also out there training. I had an economist named Stan Angerman at the University of Rochester who covers sports. Talked about how in that era in the 1960s, you see somebody running around, you were wondering who had they robbed So I think there's a whole cultural shift whereby running became acceptable, but also just more common. And so what I was interested in finding out is, well, was there this running boom just in the 70s? We're seeing these huge races these days. Certainly there's been at least another boom, or are we in a third boom? What happened to the numbers? And what I found was that I think we are still in that first running boom. I wouldn't break it up into separate booms. If you look at the annual growth rate of marathon finishers from 76 to 80, you had 472%. You had crazy growth. From 80 to 90, you had 5.7% annual growth. From 90 to 2000, you had 5.7% annual growth again. From 2000 to 2010, you had 4.4% annual growth. So basically, let me just go back to correct, from 76 to 80, it was 94.4% annual growth. So basically, you had this crazy spike from 76 to 80, and since then, you've had about 5.7% and then 4.4% for this last decade. It's been a pretty even increase. Now, there was a spike from 2008 to 2010. You had a big 19% spike in marathon finishers. So basically, you're looking at a mountain that has steeper and less steep sections, but it's all the same mountain, is what I'm seeing.
So there was no real dip. I mean, I think that's what probably most people conceive of, that you have like the Frank Shorter boom, and maybe was it Jim Fix who had the book? I don't know if that's
1977.
And then he died of a heart attack, and maybe not long after that, people started thinking running was a bad thing or bad for your knees. It just...
I think that's overstated, and I think that's the point that I get from looking at the numbers, is that the whole idea that there was a plateau or a dip is overstated, because the data really hasn't changed much from 1980 to 2010. So certainly there was this huge spike in the 70s, and the growth since 1980 has been impressive, but it has been fairly consistent. There wasn't a big plateau. And I think, you know, people have been trying to call it in real time. And as you take a longer view of the, at least the list of marathon finishers, there hasn't really been a second boom. However, I think that one way people talk about the second boom, where there has been a real shift, has been in the makeup of the finishers of the races. So in 1980, 10% of marathon finishers were women. In 2011, 41% of marathon finishers were women. And if you just take road race finishers, in 1990, you had a quarter of road race finishers were women. In 2011, it's 55%. So there's been a huge shift in the gender balance or imbalance of races since the 70s. And So the runner, the makeup of a race today is very different from the makeup of a race back then. But it doesn't really mean we're in a second boom if you look at just total number of finishers. I think we're still in the first one. Now, running isn't the only thing that's boomed. I mean, population has boomed as well. We've gone from around 200 million to 310 million people in the United States. But that's about a 1% annual increase. So certainly the popularity of running has outstripped that, and it has outstripped as well the popularity of gym memberships. So I think that once we've established that more people are running, we might want to look at why and what's going to happen in the future.
So sort of on that note, I guess, you know, you talked about the sort of demographic shift, but do you think it's encompassing more, is it a different collection of goals now than it was in the sort of the early part of the boom? Was it more just about racing and fitness then, and maybe now more about other things like personal achievement or fundraising for a cause and so forth?
Yeah, I think that the charity element actually is one thing that really might have contributed to the spike from 2008 to 2010. I think that's a fairly recent addition. I think that, you know, one of the books I read in researching this topic is called The Running Revolution by Joe Henderson. I'll talk about him a little bit more later. But he was writing in the late 70s and in 1980 about the tension between the elites and now the the back of the packers who are, or, you know, the everyday runners who are running sort of more for fun and for social reasons, or certainly not as fast. You know, in my own experience, I've never felt that tension necessarily between people who are really fast and people who are running behind them in the big pack. But I think that those issues that people talk about now were actually already, had already appeared in, you know, in 1980, in the late 70s. So I think as soon as the numbers started escalating, you started to get sort of a slowing of the average time or the median time in the race. And I think that that trend has certainly continued, that times have gotten slower.
Yeah, you know, I happen to look at New York Marathon times. I know you did tons of research. I did a little bit. I looked at New York Marathon times, and the median times have been increasing progressively just throughout the race's history since it started in 1970. And obviously the amount of people has been growing steadily. As you say, no dip in the late 80s or 90s. It was just a steady progression upwards to the current 40-some thousand finishers that the race gets. But what I found was interesting is that the percentage of starters who finish has risen very sharply from, you know, in the 70s, it was typically 60 to 70% of finishers. And in the 80s, you started to see it rising to sort of low 90s and then high 90s after that. And these days, according to the numbers that I put together, the last 10 years, it's been 98%. Plus, and in 2010 and 2011, it was 99.5% and 99.1%. People just finish marathons, unlike, by the way, you and I did in Boston.
Yeah,
almost a year ago. But but that's a whole other story we'll get to. But I think people see it as, again, personal achievement. You're just there to finish. I mean, there are a lot of people racing up front, but even they, you know, finishing is just much more important goal than it was in 1976, when I think, which was the first five-borough marathon in New York, 74% finished. So if they were having a bad day, they just, a quarter of them got on the subway.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you see that among the elites in the major marathons. If they're having a bad day, they'll drop out. So the true elites, the people who are getting paid, who are making a living doing this stuff, will drop out at a higher rate than the rest of us. So certainly I think that shows that, you know, maybe in the older marathons, the people who were there to seriously try to get their best time and didn't have that same drive just to finish the race. So, of course, a lot of people who want just to finish the race are also trying to get a good time. But maybe for them the overriding value is just to finish.
Right.
So I think we've covered the what of the running boom. I think the why is an interesting question, and you know, I cited a few books, and Frank Shorter won the marathon, Joan Benoit in 84 won the Olympics in the first women's marathon. But I think one maybe dominant factor in all this is simply that there was money to be made by organizing the races. And once sort of, we call it sort of commodification of the road race took place, there were a lot of forces that were encouraging people to get out there and run. I mean, you could say that Jim Fix had an incentive to sell his book, but he had a message, right? But there were, you know, the digital watch started selling late in the 1970s. And I don't know whether that was inspired by runners, but certainly having a digital watch would help them, instead of running with a stopwatch, you run with a digital watch and they feel like you're more mainstream. But all the stuff that people buy that's affiliated with running. So Runner's World magazine went monthly in 1973. So along with Runner's World comes a lot of ads for things for runners to buy. So it could be gear, it could be shoes. Of course, Nike ascended during the running boom. And now, you know, every marathon has its expo. And every expo has all the gear, all the stuff that the organizers are trying to chuck at you, and that people are, you know, willing to buy. So I think that there's an incentive now for, you know, local governments and businesses. There's an incentive for a lot of people besides the runners themselves to put on races. And I think another factor in the and the why is simple demographics. We had the running boom coincided with sort of an exercise age for the baby boomers. So one boom fed another. The birth rates were very high in this country from 1946 to 1964 and 65 actually, but then they came down, and the baby boomers are considered those born from 46 to 64. So these people were all sort of at our peak road race ages, sort of 20 to 39, and to 49 now. And these people, I think, really helped sustain the boom, particularly during the 80s and the 90s. And I think the growth, actually, that's been a little slower from 2000 to 2010, at least in terms of marathon finishers, I think that slowing may have something to do with a lot of those boomers getting older and hanging up the shoes,
mm-hmm.
at least as far as completing marathons goes.
Right.
So I actually see the growth over the last 10 years and you know, particularly the spike after the economic downturn in 2007, spike 2008, 2010, as particularly impressive. And maybe, you know, more charity runners or, you know, Carmen pitching more watches or whatnot. You know, I don't know what happened. Maybe the people getting having more time on their hands, being unemployed, wanting some kind of meaningful purpose. There must be better reasons. But for whatever reason, the boom has sustained. And it's extremely impressive, I think. So I think that, you know, that touches on some of the why that isn't out there as much in the media right now.
Okay.
So then we turn to what happens next? Where do we go from here? Can we expect, you know, annual growth of 4.4% or higher in the years to come? And I think what I see right now is perhaps, but maybe not in the U.S. So I looked at the marathons run so far this year in the U.S., and it's interesting that I think out of 28 marathons that were run in the U.S. this year and last year, 18 of them have had fewer finishers, 9 of them have had more finishers, and one of them has had the same. So actually, in basically twice as many races, you're seeing less finishers. There's a clear way to say that. There are 2 times more races that have fewer finishers than more finishers, comparing this year to last year, looking at marathons. However, the data is mixed because the overall number of marathon finishers so far this year compared to those races last year is up because the Disney World Marathon and their 20th anniversary marathon was a real blowout. They had 20,700 runners. They had basically 7,000 more than last year. So that big race got a lot bigger. And then there are 2 other just quick points I wanted to make. Just this week, the Naperville Marathon, their first year in Naperville, a town in Illinois, I think 174th biggest city in the U.S. So it's sort of a mid-sized city, I guess you'd call it. It sold out its marathon in one day, and that was January 28th, last Monday. So they had 3,500 slots for the half marathon and full marathon. It sold out in one day, and now they're going to add, I think, 500 charity slots, so people will have a chance to sign up for charity. An interesting tidbit that came out in the news about that was that due to some protests apparently on social media, the price was cut on the half marathon from $105 to $75, and on the full marathon from $150 to $115. Now, I'm impressed that, you know, social media could cut this price, particularly when there's such demand for a race that it sells out in one day. Generally, when you have such high demand, the price will remain high. But that's an indicator that the market isn't completely saturated yet. If you can throw a marathon together with 3,500 runners, which is not necessarily that small a marathon, there are many, many smaller marathons, and have it sell out in one day. Perhaps there are a lot of cities that might be in the sort of the Naperville 174th highest population in the country in that range somewhere, you'd want to put together marathons. And finally, I'll point to a huge running boom and that's currently going on in Japan. Five of the 15 most populous marathons last year were in Japan, in the globe. So in Japan, there's been a 240% increase in marathon finishers over the last 5 years. So that's a 48% annual growth. Now, we're talking about in the U.S. From 2000 to 2010, a 4.4% annual growth. And the marathon last year actually only grew by 2%. In 2011 grew by 2%. And last year may actually have fallen because we didn't have New York. So the number of marathon finishers in the U.S. last year may have gone down. So basically, I think that the marathon itself in the U.S. will likely grow very slowly at this point, whereas in Japan, it seems to be just skyrocketing, and they're, for whatever reason, enjoying something akin to what we had in the 1970s, just in terms of the rate of growth. Certainly, people have been running in Japan for a long time, but it's caught fire there. And then finally, the last stat I'll throw to you is in 2012, the Tokyo Marathon, with 35,500 slots, had 10 times that number of applicants. So you think it's hard to get into New York, it's hard to get into Tokyo, too. And, of course, Tokyo was added as the World Marathon Major 6 marathon. So it makes a lot of sense to have one of those in Japan.
Very interesting. You know, just anecdotally, we know a lot of the European countries are, you know, running and marathoning has been big there for a while. It's not a new thing. We see a lot of them coming over for the New York Marathon and other large marathons in the U.S. But just anecdotally, traveling to Brazil every now and then with my wife is originally from there, and we visit there about once a year. 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would go for a run, and I just felt like I was getting strange looks. I'm not sure I was, but it just seemed like it wasn't a thing in this relatively mid-sized city that we visit, my wife's hometown. When I went earlier last year, there was a section where there were just tons of joggers going around this new housing development. Some running with their dogs. It was just like a running scene, and I had never seen a running scene in Brazil. And my friend, a friend of mine who's in the large city of Sao Paulo, said that there's a 5K and a 10K every weekend there, much like what we see in Central Park. So I guess a lot of countries are entering the boom. A lot of countries have already been in the boom, but it's just interesting to see how it's developing overseas.
Yeah, yeah. I could see. I mean, in Brazil, you've got some great runners, Marilson Gomes dos Santos, and I'm curious. You know, there are theories that Frank Shorter and Joan Benoit really pushed the boom. I'm curious whether in those places, how much difference does it make when you've got somebody really at the front of the pack on the global scene?
Exactly.
Well,
good stuff.
And I think we can use that to segue to our elite scene. I think we're going to talk a little bit about the meet at Boston over the weekend. Of course, the most highly anticipated event was Galen Rupp's run against Dijon Gebremeskel and Hagos Gebrewet, some very swift Ethiopians. And I think that in Rupp, we've got somebody who on the global scene is now one of the top sort of five runners in, I'd say, from the 3,000 to the 10,000. So we have a real elite runner. He's basically reached the level, I think, that Ryan Hall reached, if not surpassed it, given that Rupp has got a silver in the Olympics. And I'm curious to see whether he'll get more publicity. He's not really that. He's not really sort of a Saturday Night Live kind of personality. You know, one might imagine Kara Goucher, if she ever won something, being on SNL. It's hard for me to imagine Rupp being on SNL. But having somebody at the very front of these races, we'll see what happens. At any rate, Greg, I know you were watching that race closely, so why don't you sort of bring us through what you saw?
Well, yeah, you had a very nice little recap on our website, cloud259.com. I just thought it was really interesting how First of all, I don't think it was an upset because the two Ethiopians have sub-27 sub-13
5Ks. Yeah, sub-13 5Ks, yeah.
Right, I'm thinking of the 10K times. So
they were sub-12 55Ks at that, too.
Yeah, exactly. But I was struck by how early Gebrewet made his move on Rupp, a pretty decisive move at about the 2K mark of the 3,000. So with five laps to go, Gebrewet took over and put some separation between himself and Rupp pretty soon. And then before you knew it, he had 20 meters on him, maybe 30. And Rupp almost closed the gap. I mean, it wasn't really that close, but Rupp closed on him in the last two laps and made it a little bit closer than that. But in after the race, I'm thinking that's in a way a compliment to Rupp. It's saying to Rupp that I respect your kick, the kick that both he and Mo Farah showed in London in the final laps. That's the kind of move that typically an American would have to make real early against an East African and to try to take out the kick from away from the East African. It was almost like the situation was reversed.
That's interesting, and Rupp certainly did come at him with a kick. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, do you think that was the reason he did it, or do you think it was simply a surprise tactic, or he was just feeling really good at that point in the race?
It's hard for me to say for sure. It would just be my guess. But I think if he were confident that he was just a faster on the last 200 meters than Rupp, then why would he go that early? I mean, he would just be on his shoulder and just wait and just go like we've seen others do.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It was an impressive race. It was a very surprising race. It certainly lived up to its billing. I'm glad that meet was sold out because I think they got their money's worth. I think that it was very surprising to see Gebremesco get dusted so early. He fell off. And then to see Gebrewet make his move on Rupp that early. And Rupp, it seemed like he was just hitting those splits, 60-second quarters.
Yeah, Gebremesco should have lost a shoe. He's a lot faster when he's winning.
Exactly. His fastest race in that meet has been when he was shoeless.
Yeah.
I thought in some of the other races in that meet, too, there were surprising tactics. And the boys' high school mile, and the high school mile is always fun to watch, I think, because you see a lot of shifts up and down and on both the boys' and the girls' side. In the boys' race, the guy who won it, he took it out really hard. And then he eased back. He strung out the pack, basically, and then he eased back. And then right as he was about to get past, late in the race, he turned on the jets again. It was almost as if he was sort of running the legs out of the other runners and then using part of the race to recover and then knowing that he had the best kick. I mean, I'm not sure if on paper he had the best kick, but he certainly did have the best kick yesterday. And it was just unusual for me to see that type of front running. Mm-hmm. To actually work. And then in the men's elite mile too, you had Centrowitz who seemed to be to sort of using that technique of staying half a step ahead of his competition, and Will Lear gave him quite a run at the end there. I was sort of hoping he would take it from Centrowitz, but it didn't quite happen. I think Centrowitz is sort of becoming one of the best runners at winning by a little bit. And that's in contrast to someone like Legat, who's going to sit on the shoulder of whoever's in front and then just slingshot in the last 200 meters. And speaking of Legat, Viola Legat was in the race in the women's mile yesterday and running for Kenya, interestingly. And I was struck at just how, they show her at the start and you think, oh, geez, her face looks a lot like Bernard Legat's Viola. It makes sense. They're siblings. But when she runs, she had the same style. She had the same sort of like very smooth looking, a little bit of back and forth sort of swaying. And then with half a lap to go, you see her acceleration. You know, her legs flying just like Bernard Lagat. And she really shot the gap pretty well late in the race to put herself in position. And I was just sorry, that's uncanny. You know, my siblings run, but I don't think we look anything like one another when we run. But she actually looks like Lagat. So I think she's probably got a bright future because that's a pretty smooth style.
I didn't see that race. Did she have the big wide eyes in the final stretch?
That was the one thing. You know, they weren't really focused on her the way they focus on Lagat when he gets all bug-eyed at the end. But, no, they didn't show that. I don't think that she had him. I think if she did have him, that they would have showed that. Mm-hmm. And she didn't win. So, I mean, she came in third, I believe. So we didn't get that extreme close-up.
So the other performance we wanted to note was just today in Japan, where Yuki Kawauchi won the Beppu Ueta Marathon in a personal best for him of 2:08:15. And why is it notable? Well, Yuki is sort of a notorious figure on especially the Let'sRun.com message boards. He's a favorite of people who like to see people run all the time, and that's essentially what he does. He runs marathons almost all the time. He made news in December by running back-to-back 2:10s, I think 2 weeks apart, which was apparently a record. No one had ever run two 2:10, sub-2:11 essentially, marathons within 2 weeks. And earlier in January, he ran a course record in Egypt of 2:12 and winning that marathon. And 2 weeks after that, here he runs his personal best of 2:08:15. And oh, by the way, in between those four marathons, he'd won a bunch of other races. He'd run in Ekiden and some other, so maybe a half marathon, which I think he won. So he's just an incredible figure, just runs all the time and seems to get stronger and stronger. It's just remarkable. I think he kind of goes against the old adage that you can only run two top shelf marathons a year at your best. Although I guess some people might say, well, maybe he would be even better if he only ran two. Maybe he'd be a 2:05 guy, but I'm not quite so sure.
Yeah, I think that, and that's something that in future episodes certainly we'll get into, is all the different ways that people approach training and running.
Mm-hmm.
And I the only thing that bothers me is when somebody says, you know, you can't do that. I think runners basically find their own path.
Right.
But his path seems to be one of sacrifice, I think.
Yeah, I don't think this strategy would work with say a Nathan Ritzenhine, for example.
No, right.
Unless he were doing it underwater or on an Alter G or something.
Certainly not.
Yep. So we'll look ahead. I guess what are the big events coming up? We have the Milrose in 2 weeks, and I guess the Japan Marathon, Tokyo Marathon is in 3 weeks. That's now a World Marathon Major, so that'll be interesting. I think Yuki will be there. I would assume so. Anything else coming up in the elite scene?
Well, just I'd say, you know, we also saw Tirunesh Dibaba, the PG Face Destroyer, destroy another field yesterday. I know that Mary Kane got a lot of attention for her fantastic race as well, but we don't want to lose from that story, the fact that Dibaba has just dominated that whole meet for the last decade, basically. Pretty much after the first few times she's run, every time she's run that meet, she's won her race, usually by a lot. And she was quite a bit faster yesterday than she was last year in Olympic year in her two-mile race. I think last year she was struggling a little with the injuries, but we're looking forward to seeing her run the London Marathon. And we mentioned this also on the site, cloud259.com. It's probably a good time to note just a bit of our overall strategy with these podcast episodes and also with our site. We're just going to try to chip in angles on running news where we see it. We're going to try to report the news slightly differently from where we're seeing it reported elsewhere, so that those of you who have insatiable appetites for running news, or just those who want a bit of running news and like the way we present it, we'll find it on our site. So we're not going to cover everything. We don't have a world bureau, but we'll cover what strikes us as interesting. So we put a note up about the Baba today and Roth and also Legat.
Yeah, and any time, any chance we have to say the words babyface destroyer, we will say it. I promise. All right, Brent, so we have another section we call the library. You actually went to the library and looked up some running books. What did you find?
Yeah, well, finding data is an interesting thing, and it's not always easy. The data is not always completely trustworthy because sometimes the people providing you the data also have an interest in the data looking a certain way. Now, for a lot of the data that I used for this show, I got online, and a lot of it came from runningusa.org, which has an industry conference, and certainly they have an interest in seeing the number of runners increase. However, I did check that. You know, Runner's World uses their data, and I think that I think they're fairly reliable. However, one shouldn't just look to the internet for information. So, I tried to get some background on the running boom by going to the library, and I was pleasantly surprised. If you go to the call number 796 or 796.42, you'll find books on running, and a couple of the books had the same authors, so I thought, okay, I'll check this out. One of them I've been enjoying quite a bit, in part for the pictures, called Running Encyclopedia, The Ultimate Source for Today's Runner. And it's by Joe Henderson, who used to be the editor of Runner's World in the 1970s, and also Richard Benio. I got another book online, cheap. You can get a lot of cheap, old, used books online, called The Running Revolution by Joe Henderson. So I got into this Joe Henderson guy's stuff, and I don't love all of it, and this isn't going to be a go buy this stuff now kind of endorsement, but he spent a lot of time running, and he spent a lot of time writing about running, and there are some nice nuggets in his books, where as a runner I just thought, you know what, I agree with that. He's sort of telling it like it is, and for someone who for a long time, I think, was trying to push a magazine, Runner's World, that has sort of investor interests at heart, in part. He's come out of it, I think, pretty unscathed, and that I believe what he writes. I believe that he believes what he writes. He doesn't have just positive things to say about everybody. And that book, Running Encyclopedia, is pretty comprehensive. It's about, let's see, 400 some odd pages. It was published in 2001, so you're not going to get a lot of information about Galen Rupp in there. But what you will get is, among other things, a lot of pictures of people who won the Boston Marathon, spanning back, from the early to the early 1900s. And some pretty neat pictures, and also just little stories of all these runners that have long been forgotten or never heard of by people like me. And you also get sort of a sense of how at some point these major marathons were not dominated by Kenyans and Ethiopians, and you get people from anywhere in the world winning them. Now, that's nothing against Kenyans and Ethiopians, but it's just interesting to see and to read some of these stories, including some Canadians who've won some big races in the past that I never knew. So,
what did the people look like from the real early days, the winners? What were they wearing? Were they wearing like long pants and smoking cigarettes, or?
some of them look pretty stylish, actually. There's a picture of John Kelly from 1935, yep, where he looks, like a singlet and some running shorts that I wouldn't mind having myself these days.
Uh-huh.
What can I tell you? I mean, the photos are black and white. They look sweaty. they look happy. I think one thing you notice is that you notice the people on the streets towards the finish line at Boston. They're all far better dressed than the people lining the finish line at Boston are these days. A lot of hats and ties and coats. A lot of slaps on the back, you know, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. I think this is the kind of thing that people who have subway commutes could get into, these sorts of books. If you have an extremely busy life and nothing, no time in it, I wouldn't dive towards them, but also good for the person who's just interested in running in general. And
I'm sorry if you said this, but when did Henderson write these books?
Henderson wrote a lot of books, and The Running Encyclopedia was published in 2001. The Running Revolution was published, I believe, in 1980 or 1981, and it includes pieces that he wrote from 1976 to 1980. He also has a website, joehenderson.com, and on that website you'll get an article once a week, and he's an extremely consistent guy, this guy. The articles go back over a decade. So one can, you know, read his stuff online for a long time. He's one of these people who believed in streaks, Greg. I think you're more of a believer in streaks than I am in training, but he had some pretty absurd streaks of about 4 years of running every day. But also, he also wrote every day, so I find that very impressive.
Interesting. Well, speaking of training and speaking of streaks, I'm definitely not on a running streak right now. Probably maybe the opposite, but let's talk a little training, Brent. So first off, how's your training going?
Well, February, I've decided it's hell month. So every day in February, I want to make myself cry just a little bit because I need to get in shape.
And so how are you making yourself cry?
By trying to get in shape faster than most people would recommend I try to do. I'm running the New York half in the middle of March, so I want to be in shape enough for that so that I can run a time that, say, 125 or so. And I'm coming from being out of shape, it's going to be a challenge.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's been kind of tough stretch for me for, I don't know, 4 months or so. I've had various injuries, which are thankfully completely behind me. I had a little plantar fasciitis, a little ITBS, and in between a really bad cold, but a much better reason now to not be training so much, a newborn baby daughter, our second child, and she's incredibly great, and so not a lot of incentive to be away from her and pounding the pavement. So I figure I'll be taking it easy for a little while, not doing the quick ramp up that you're doing in February. But when the weather turns a little bit better, I'll be getting the old jogging stroller out, I assume, and getting back into it. But I'm not planning a spring marathon like I am most years. But I think we wanted to talk a little bit about a subject that I guess we've both been grappling with, which is training whilst not in shape, and various sort of strategies, either technical strategies or just sort of attitudes to help through these periods when we're just not really putting in the kind of consistent miles for whatever reason. So did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, two quick ones. One, something that my sister used last year to help her get in shape. I told her that she came from being completely out of shape. I said, you know what, you might not feel good the first day you run or the second day or the third day, but after 2 weeks when you go for a run, you will feel better than you did on that first day. But basically after 2 weeks of starting something, you will feel better at it. So she took this to heart as sort of like a 15-day streak that you have to go on a 15-day streak where every day you do something for 15 days. And I did not object to that, because though I don't like streaks, I think that one thing a streak will force you to do, if you're coming from being out of shape to getting in shape, is to organize your life so that you make the time to do the work, to do the exercise. And after 15 days, you should be in better shape. So I actually tried to incorporate that myself. I had the flu a few weeks ago, and I thought, okay, now's the time to get back into it now that this is over. And I lasted around 3 days, and then, you know, I didn't do anything the fourth day, so I tossed that. So thought, okay, well, let's try a more gradual approach. I will, instead of a 15-day streak, try to do more this week than I did last week. So every week I'll try to do more than I did the week before. That is sticking. But I also have the I also have this half marathon coming up and potentially a track race on March 9th. So I've decided, okay, I will do more each week than I did the week before, and I'm also going to try to make February a hell month, basically, and jack up the training big time and see if that'll work. So it's been working for 4 days, but we'll check in next week.
I think you're a guy, Brent, who likes being at rock bottom and digging out of it. I think you get a little bit of a challenge out of that.
I think that training is like, I think you're on a sine curve, and the sine curve goes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're training, you're on the curve somewhere. And I like to not bottom out so badly that I just, you know, I fall off the graph. So I try to take heart that there are times when you are not in great shape, but when you are training at those times, you can see pretty rapid improvement, and that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little harder to motivate. I think that the great thing about being in fantastic shape is that I find it's easy to motivate at those times. It's easy to get out there and automatically do 10 miles a day or whatnot.
Yeah, the one thing that's helped me, it's sort of a little bit of a twist on your perspective. It's, you know, it is hard when you're just running, let's say, two or three days a week, and you just don't have the time, and the weather's terrible, and you just can't get out there, because obviously you run, let's say, what would ordinarily be a moderate pace, and it's pretty hard, and then that can be a little bit depressing. But I've been able to, especially since I'm not injured, so I'm not in pain trying to run. I've really focused on the after effect of the workout. So let's say I hop on a treadmill and I do a quick three miler at, say, you know, 7:45 pace or something, just throwing that out, or even 8 minute pace. That's going to feel kind of hard now. It should feel easy. But if I forget about that, once the workout's over, I still get the same sort of afterglow, that still positive feeling of having had an aerobic exercise. And I feel good about my day. I feel like at least, you know, I did something and I got the blood moving, got the blood pumping, and I'm not too focused on any race in the near term. So I just focus on that. And I kind of have this saying to myself that any day where I get a run in is a good day, particularly if I haven't caused an injury or anything like that. So that's what I've been going with. And that's what I'll stick with. That's what I'll stick with for now.
Yeah. Now, do you like, I know, Greg, you've done a lot of marathons. How many have you done? What, 29?
Yeah.
So is this the first time in a while that you haven't had one on the schedule?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good point. I think it may be the first one in quite a while. Well, I can't remember the last time I didn't have one sort of pinpointed. I was going to run, I was thinking about running Eugene in the spring, which is right around when Boston is. It's in April, Eugene, Oregon, Tracktown, USA. But I'm not going to run that, obviously, with the new baby and the difficulty. And I'm happily not running it. So happily not running a spring marathon. But I guess now that you mention it, I'll have to think about what I'm doing in the fall.
Well, I think it's good. You know, it's going to take the long view. And must be a bit of a relief for you not to have one on the schedule.
A little bit.
Not an imposing date. I'm signed up for the New York Marathon this year. So I'll probably be running that, but I always like to leave a little wiggle room, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My training's not going well. I likely will not run it. So don't want to put the cart before the horse, but it is good to does get you out the door having one on the calendar.
So should we move on to the soapbox?
Yeah, let's I guess it's one last point. Greg mentioned the treadmill, and I think when you're out of shape and when it's cold out, it's good to get on the treadmill. You can try and beat your treadmill time from the day before.
Right.
Some people call it the treadmill, but it's not that bad.
I like what's
better than doing nothing.
I really like what friend of the show Joe Garland said on his New York Runner Show, which we've been on many times, and you were on this past week. He said, don't call it a treadmill. We use that term, you know, it's a funny term, But it's negative thinking. It kind of makes it seem worse than it is. It kind of puts you in the frame of mind that it's a torture apparatus or something like that. And in the winter, when it's, you know, when it's snowing and it's just there's ice on the ground, and or we have a cold or something like that, it is a useful thing. So
yeah,
you know, call it the treadmill. And when it's summertime and 60 degrees, 70 degrees outside and sunny, and people are still in the gym packing on those treadmills.
Yeah. All right, so on to the soapbox. Now, Greg, you had something to get off your chest this week.
Yeah, so today's soapbox, the inaugural soapbox, is about, coincidentally, soap. I got an email the other day from something called the 5K Foam Fest. I don't know if you've heard of this, and I had no idea what it was, but according to the email, it's, quote, an amazing mix of foam and ginormous inflatable obstacles. According to the organizers, who are, seems like they're trying to find a niche like those popular mud runs, which we didn't include in all of your running boom stats, but I know that they've been growing
yeah,
astronomically.
On the rise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, this email, Brent said, this is a direct quote. It says, "This year, foam is the new mud." So if you didn't know 2013 was the year of foam, well, now you know.
The inflatable obstacles. I'm still stuck on that.
Right.
Balloons or what? You know, what?
Yeah, you know, it gets better. So I had a bunch of questions, like, you know, what is this foam made of? Is it toxic? What if someone goes into some allergic shock or something? Are there paramedics among the foam spewers, or is it just covered by some liability waiver? The email goes on to say, again, a direct quote, "We've added a bunch of obstacles like the 30-foot slip and slide, puddle jumping, and the stumpy jumper, whatever that is, to keep your 3.2 miles fun and challenging." Okay, now wait a minute. I thought to myself, 3.2 miles for a 5K? Before we get to the stumpy jumper and everything, is there a different metric system on Planet Foam? Can they not fit all their stumpy jumpers and slip and slides into the requisite 3.1 miles? Do they even know how long a 5K is? Are they not runners? Which gets me to the basic point of this soapbox, which is to say that, in my view, this is not a running event. It's some combination of amusement park ride, car wash, frat house challenge, and remember that kids game from the I think it was maybe the early 90s, Double Dare. Remember that show, Brent?
Yeah.
So it's about as far from running as that Brady Bunch episode where Bobby puts too much detergent in the laundry machine is from Chariots of Fire. I think. In comparison to it makes the mud run look normal by comparison. But I'm not saying the mud run is running. I kind of.
But I guess this is getting you clean, right?
I guess it's getting you clean after the mud run. Yeah, maybe I should have like a back to back. I kind of roll my eyes, or I try to avoid rolling my eyes when I'm talking running with someone and they bring up a mud run. But at least in real. You know, cross-country races, you'll see, depending on what the conditions are like, you'll see some mud in a real cross-country race. You'll see runners cross the line, you know, with mud on all over themselves. But when was the last time you saw, like, Dathan Ritzenhain get doused with detergent? Although, you never know, Alberto Salazar may have tried that once. But I'm not saying... Yeah, he tries everything. I'm not saying I'm against these non-running events. I suppose it's fun for those who are into it, and I'm not opposed to fun. As you know, Brent, I've sometimes put on an elf suit or a business suit for the Wall Street Run.
Right.
What the Brits call fancy dress. And as I get slower with age, maybe I'll do a little bit more of that. And then I was also thinking, you know, they've been running with the bulls in Pamplona since the 14th century. So maybe, who knows, the Foam Fest will achieve some sort of cultural legitimacy in a few hundred years. But it still won't be running. Just want to get that clear. So we have a little promise on the cloud. After this little soapbox, we will not discuss any events involving mud or foam or Jell-O or Cheese Whiz. We won't give training tips for the slip and slide or how to crawl under barbed wire. And we won't discuss which makes for a faster course, Tide or Palmolive. But before we leave the topic of foam forever, I have one idea, and it's for Lance Armstrong. Lance, if you're listening, and I'm sure he is, If you want to compete but are banned from running, triathlon, and cycling for life, if you need an outlet for that tremendous drive, that win-at-all-costs mentality, then please take on the 5K Foam Fest. Who knows? For this comeback, it may help you get clean.
Yeah, Lance. Yeah, what's left for him? The mud runs or the Foam Fest? Well, you know, I'm going to disobey what you said. I am going to mention one last thing about that. I was a friend of mine had asked me to join a race in New Jersey, his team, for one of these mud run type of races, and I looked at the description of the race, and one of the selling points is that there was an electric fence on it, and I thought, how on earth can they sanction? Can this be legal? And why would anybody try to do this? I mean, one of my life skills, not getting electrocuted. So thanks for that, Craig. That's that sounds bizarre. I am a little bit curious how that race went for those who did it and what it actually looked like.
Maybe I'll we'll put the this email just on the site somewhere so people can see the details.
Dig up some pictures from that, but yes, we shall not be covering that. We shall not be covering that as a topic, as the workout of our episodes at any rate. So, looking ahead, the next episode we'll do, perhaps in a few weeks, we'll keep our site Cloud 259 updated to let people know, and we'll be posting this stuff. Tonight we looked at the running boom, and for the next episode we're going to look at are all these people running? Is anyone watching the running? What's the state of the pro scene? Maybe there isn't quite the excitement about running from the audience as there is from the runners themselves. We'll have a look. So once again, this is episode 1 of Cloud259.com, running on air. And my name is Brent Jones, and I'm here with Greg Lingelstein, and we're going to sign off. Until next time. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening.